and hell surprise. Cosmic Cummies arrived. 12 transmission steel buys the seats where science, myth, and magic meet. From 61 into the 70, exponential growth only in humanity. I'm a vagabond.
It's incredible.
I'm a
Hey there, and welcome to Marvel by the Month, the podcast that takes you through the history of Marvel Comics one month at a time. In this episode, that month is December of 1967. My name is Brian Stratton.
And mine is Rob Milne.
Rob, usually we will start out with some banter, and I just have banter written down in our notes because I had no idea what to put in there. I'm like, I'll think of something before showtime. As it turns out, this day supplied plenty of things that we could reflect upon.
Yeah, it is another historical, and the word I hate the most that I hear all the time in the last 4 years, unprecedented day. Every time I hear unprecedented, I want it to be unprecedented, but it doesn't work out that way.
Yeah. So in the last 24 hours, the Democrats won two races in Georgia for the Senate, for which they were underdogs for both of them, which means that I believe the South as a whole has elected its first black senator ever. And Georgia has elected its first Jewish person to statewide office ever.
Yeah.
So kind of mind blowing. And I thought, well, surely this is going to be the biggest news that we get for this week. I mean, this is it. And then and what happened just a few hours later?
Oh, man, the pro-Trump insurrectionists literally did an insurrection. Like, the people have not gotten into the Capitol building. They didn't get in during the Civil War. You know, this is the first time a riot has resulted and an insurrection has resulted in someone breaking in, and someone was shot and killed in the incident. You know, I know that I'm sure that the people controlling it were worried about guns outside of the Capitol, so they were trying not to start gunfire, but it still occurred. So it's just a, like, these are things that we, you know, rip from the headlines from the 60s, and it's getting weirder than that. Like, we started this podcast saying, well, yeah, we had Vietnam, but at least, and we're not dealing with the civil rights issues and the kinds of things they were dealing with then. Now I'm like, yeah, it's a toss up. We're really in interesting times.
Yes. One might say unprecedented.
Yes, one might.
I'm really looking forward to 2020 being done, quite honestly. I thought years were only supposed to go like 366 days at most, but now we're like at 370 something.
Yeah, it's going to keep going for another 14 for sure, at least.
Yeah. Well, I'm excited to think about literally anything other than what has been going on today. So let's bring our guest in this week. He is making his fourth appearance on the show, which is awesome.
Four-peat. Yeah.
Yeah. And he's here because his mom asked us very nicely to have him back on. And we're happy to do it. Also, he knows his Marvel Comics inside and out. You know him as customer number zero at Books with Pictures. It's Jamie James Wanger.
Hey, Jamie. Thanks for that warm introduction. That's like teeing up I think I've ever gotten.
I think it was after the last episode we had you on, I was talking to Katie Proctor from Books with Pictures, and she mentioned that you were a pre-customer. You were not even her first customer. She had not even opened the store, and you stormed in there and demanded to buy comic books from
her. So for a while, my friend and I had our own little startup business in the Ford building. Yep. And so on my walk there, I would pass by that little shopping area, And I saw something was opening up there. And every day I was walking by and seeing like things happening, boxes were being delivered. And I got curious and in a uncharacteristically friendly and outgoing moment, I like knocked on the door and was like, hey, I'm a human. What do humans say to each other in this sort of situation? Like, how will you be selling wares that I might? Like, I don't know. It was so bumbling and awkward. And she was like, I will be selling comic books. And I was like, oh no, I've been trying to quit comic books. And now it's like a direct path.
That happened exactly to me because I also worked in the Ford building, after you, at an agency there. So that was right as they were really getting open and moving, you know, moving the books. So I was like, I walked by it seriously for probably 2 months. Kept walking by, talking to Barb about it. Like, there's this comic book store. It looks really cool. Mm-hmm. Then Brian mentions it. And I'm like, I got to go start buying comics again. Here we go.
I don't want to. I'm trying to be a grown up. And it's not going to work.
And then the drum shop I love moved over into the same neighborhood too. So it was the two places that I like purposefully don't go into a music store. I don't go into comic stores if I can help it because I'm trying not to spend money. Now I'm like... And now with COVID is just like, well, I'm helping books with pictures every time I make an order. Yep. So, yeah.
You got to support your local comic book stores. They need us more than ever. And if there's any empty space on your bookshelves, you need to fill that. It's your moral obligation.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah. Jamie, so I'm trying to get people on board with the idea that 2021 doesn't actually start until January 21st. How is your 2021 going so far?
Well, I actually have a similar, I've been like advancing a similar theory because, so someone told us when we were having a kid that there's this thing called the fourth trimester. And the fourth trimester is where your child has been born in a technical sense, like they are like outside their previous sort of domicile. But they're not really aware of the world in any way that actually counts. Like for all intents and purposes, they're still sort of amniotically sealed. So that's how I'm thinking of this period of 2021. Like we are in the fourth trimester of 2021, or 2020. Yeah.
We're still helpless. We're out of a womb. Yeah.
Still eating and drinking in weird ways just to kind of get through the day until we can normalize.
We should be in a pouch. Like we should be in a marsupial pouch.
But actually, I mean, outside of today's literally catastrophic events, things have been great. Yeah, trying to be a little bit more fit, trying to read a little bit more actively. I'm trying to like tear through some books and comics, and it's been okay so far.
Nice. Well, we're looking forward to going through some comics with you. But before we get into those comics that came out in December of 1967, let's talk a little bit about some of the things that were happening in the world in December of 1967. Rob, would you like to start us off?
I would love to. On the 5th of December, 1967, Dr. Benjamin Spock, not Mr. Spock, known to millions as the author of the best-selling guide to parenting, The Common Sense Book of Baby and Child Care, was among 263 anti-war protesters who were arrested for occupying the Whitehall Induction Center in New York City. Spock and poet Allen Ginsberg led a group of 1,000 demonstrators on the second day of the most recent Stop the Draft Week events.
This is a big month for music. So we have on the 1st of December, the Jimi Hendrix Experience released its second album, Axis, Bold as Love. December 7th, 1967, Otis Redding recorded Sittin' on the Dock of the Bay, which would go on to become the number one best-selling song in the United States. Very sadly, 3 days later, on the 10th, Redding was killed at the age of 26, along with four other members of the Bar K's and a pilot, when the plane he was on plunged into Lake Monona in Wisconsin at 3:25 in the afternoon. Ironically, newspapers had reported that morning that the British music publication Melody Maker had listed Redding as the world's number one vocalist, displacing Elvis Presley after 10 years.
Oh, man. And in this period of time, planes took out so many And the planes just hate musicians, mainly, you know,
very actively.
Well, no, it's wild. Like, I don't throw a lot of like plane disaster stories into these recaps, but like literally every month, there are at least five plane crashes where a bunch of people die.
They do not stay in the air during this time.
They don't. I don't know what happened. Like, if gravity was different or something. Yeah, it's wild. And then a last little bit of music news here. On the 8th of December, the Rolling Stones released their only psychedelic rock album, Their Satanic Majesty's Request, in the UK. It would be released the next day in the US. The original proposed title was Her Satanic Majesty Requests, which was a parody of the directions on British passports that began with Her Britannic Majesty's Secretary of State Requests and Requires. That title was rejected by Decca Records.
It's so cool, though. It makes the Rolling Stones like such the bad boys, you know, that they were at the time. In contrast to my favorite, my fabulous four, the Beatles. And in Beatles by the Month, on the 7th, the Apple Boutique, one of the first attempts by the Beatles to open a retail business, opened at 94 Baker Street in London to sell specially designed clothing and accessories. Because of shoplifting and poor management, the store would close on July 30th, 1968, after less than 8 months of operation. So it was one of those like startup kind of ideas. Like, let's just everybody kind of do what they want and it'll work itself out. And we're closed. on the 8th, Magical Mystery Tour was released by the Beatles as a double extended play album in the UK. It had been released with a different track list in the United States on November 27th. So just a few days later. And then just after Christmas, on the 26th of December, 67, the Beatles film Magical Mystery Tour premiered as a made-for-television movie on BBC One in the UK. British newspaper critics derided it the next day with terms like blatant rubbish, a great big bore, tasteless nonsense, and witless conceit. Paul McCartney would later respond, "Aren't we entitled to have a flop?"
Boy, I'd so want to start a spinoff podcast called Witless Conceit.
I'm sure somebody, somebody wants to give us a 5-star review, but say Witless Conceit on Apple and send that to you, we'll still give them something.
We'll send you a t-shirt.
Yeah.
Let's see. I got some movie information for you. On December 13th, 1967, Jamie Foxx, who played Electro in Amazing Spider-Man 2, was born as Eric Marlin Bishop in Terrell, Texas.
Man, yeah.
Is he playing Electro again?
The rumor is that in the next Spider-Man movie, whatever it is, a whole bunch of Spidey friends are showing up again, including Jamie Foxx as Electro. So could be some multiverse action happening.
Ooh.
On the 22nd of December, The Graduate, starring Anne Bancroft and Dustin Hoffman, made its nationwide debut a day after premiering at the Lincoln Center and at the Coronet Theater in New York and at the Four Star Theater in Los Angeles. And then a week later, on the 29th of December, The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, produced and directed by Sergio Leone and starring Clint Eastwood as the man with no name, made its debut in the United States 1 year after its Italian release as Il Buono, Il Brutto, Il Cattivo.
Whoa. Nice.
Well said.
Yeah.
Thanks.
That is one of the finest movies in pretty much what The Mandalorian is based on.
It's Mandalorian's a spaghetti Western for sure.
Yeah.
I mean, on purpose shot. Sometimes it's shot for shot when things happen. It's awesome. How about science? That's a thing. In science news, on the 14th of December, a team of biochemists at Stanford University, led by Nobel Prize winner Arthur Kornberg, announced in Stanford that they had synthesized DNA in a test tube and that they had created the first artificial virus in what was hailed as a giant step toward the creation of life itself.
Whoa.
I don't know about that.
But that's going to certainly show up at some point more in the comics very soon.
Yes.
On the 29th of December the term black hole to describe an area of gravitational collapse where the pull is so great that even visible light and other electromagnetic radiation are unable to escape was coined by Princeton University physicist John Archibald Wheeler at an after-dinner talk at the annual meeting of the American Association for the Advancement of Science in New York. Wheeler's speech would be reprinted in 1968 in an article in the journal American Scientist titled Our Universe, the Known and the Unknown. So black holes are about to start happening a lot in Marvel Comics too.
And like, that's such a, like a cultural phrase. Like everybody at least abstractly understands what a black hole is. Like if you compare someone or something to a black hole, like that's a very, but at the time that was a very new phrase and you would probably get made fun of if you use that.
Yeah. It's kind of crazy to think, I would have definitely assumed that like black holes predated Stanley and Jack Kirby coming up with Galactus, you know,
but yeah, right.
Or the dark dimension or the negative zone or
Right. Yeah. So there's a little taste of what was going on in the world in December of 1967. We will take our first break of the episode. When we come back, we will start talking about the funny books that came out in December 1967, right here on Marvel by the Month.
Welcome back to Marvel by the Month. Let's do the quick hits. Not counting fashion, romance, and Western comics or reprints, Marvel published 11 different titles in December 1967, 10 of which are available on Marvel Unlimited.
Once again, no love for Sergeant Fury.
Yeah, the Brand Eck is on there. Just put more Sergeant Fury. I would much prefer, I mean, not that I'm going to read Brand Eck again. It's a protest, but it may have gotten better. I don't know, and I will never know. Puh. Okay, so we'll talk about a few of them in detail a little bit. Here's what else came out in December of 1967. Avengers number 49, a really villainous Magneto manipulates Quicksilver and the Scarlet Witch to convince them to rejoin him and knocks the Wasp out with a fountain pen.
Pretty brutal.
That Avengers issue, I thought, was an excellent X-Men issue.
Yes. It really was.
There was like politics there. I mean, it had all the trappings of an X-Men book just with like a few Avengers in there. I thought it was really interesting.
Yep. It was a much better X-Men book than most of the X-Men books that have come out in recent memory. In our time in the Marvel by the Month zone. Yeah. Well, in Fantastic Four number 72, the Silver Surfer decides that the only way to keep humanity from destroying itself is to convince them that he's their greatest threat. But he eventually comes to his senses, and this had my panel of the month. I'm sort of doing these in line now, but page 6, panel 1 and only, it's just a beautiful Kirby Sinnott rendering of the Silver Surfer as he is flying over New York and preparing to F it up. Mm-hmm. So to teach them the lesson of unity. And it's, I also love that it's like the Ozymandias logic of bringing everyone together in fear of a common enemy. It's just such a supervillain move. And it just occurs to him like out of the blue, like, you know what I should do? I should just start blowing things up till everybody hates me. And then they'll join together.
Like unilaterally just really went for it.
It's kind of a funny issue because there's not much of a buildup to him deciding to do this. And then he almost gets killed doing it. And he immediately comes to his senses after that. And that's pretty much it.
It's a weird bottle episode.
I wonder if it was a fill-in, honestly, like if they just, you know, had some slack in the production schedule and they needed to put something in there, like Fantastic Four 51, this man, this monster, the one where the guy impersonates Ben Grimm and then like sacrifices himself to save Reed Richards.
Yeah.
Apparently that was a fill-in issue, which I didn't know until after we recorded that episode. But yeah, it's, you know, every now and then they just weren't quite ready to roll on the next thing. And
yeah, so, just did like a super self-contained.
Yeah.
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 And so, you know, Jack knocks out a Fantastic Four issue in 6 days or whatever. There you go. So,
yeah. I wonder if on those standalone ones where it's not connected to anything greater, if like Kirby has more freedom to just do stuff, kind of like take up space a little bit more expansively.
Yeah,
maybe. I mean, that's part of why you get some more splash pages. And I know Kirby's now playing with fewer panels. Like, I think playing off of Romita, he's doing like some more big panels than he used to do.
Yeah. I noticed the kind of art cross-pollination in these, like sort of cribbing from each other's style a little bit.
Yeah. I think everybody is, I mean, even Don Heck is, he's just, I shouldn't bag on him so much, but he just unfortunately has to pencil in the same group and company and time as Jack Kirby. So, you know, but I'm already starting, Brian and I are harping about, you know, inkers now. It's just this hole you go down in where you, once you've seen enough of it, you're like, ah, oh, man, I wish Joe Sinnott was inking. Vince Colletta, come on. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's a thing I've seen other people say and didn't quite get to that level of nerdity, but now I'm there. It's, yeah.
When you have to read the book every week.
Yeah, it turns out.
It's kind of fun. Okay. So Sergeant Fury number 51, which is not on Marvel Unlimited, was called The Assassin. That sounds intriguing, but you couldn't read it.
Joe Keating, write in and tell us what happened.
We should have Joe Keating just tell us what happens in every one of the Sergeant Fury issues. In Strange Tales, number 166, Dr. Strange defeats Yandross' electric drummer robot, Voltorg, and escapes with Victoria Bentley to Stonehenge, where it seems like the Ancient One might still be alive. Don't forget that Yandroth has referred to himself by my now favorite title, Science Lord. Other than that, you can forget Yandroth, except he is too cool to be lost to the ages, I guess, and was still around as of 2008.
Really?
I had to, it's another one of those villains where you're like, this villain is so lame. There is no, yep. Oh, they brought him back many times.
Wow.
But science, I wish he was just called Science Lord. That sounds like the dumbest and most awesome thing. But every time I say it to Barb, she calls me Butt Lord. So, yeah. Thanks, South Park. Nick Fury is still fighting the Yellow Claw. It's been almost like a Doctor Strange Mordo time with Agent Jimmy Woo. The Claw's niece, Su-Wan, rescues Woo from one of her uncle's death traps and literally gets fridged for her trouble.
Yes, yeah. She is iced and frozen to death.
And some very cool art.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, man. I mean,
you know, Steranko, great stuff. In fact, my panel of the month comes from this issue. And I'm kind of cheating. I just said all of page six was my panel of the month.
Oh, my God. I did the same thing.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah, absolutely.
There you go. Well, go ahead and describe it.
Yeah. Okay. So page six jumped off the, well, I guess I wanted to say page, but the virtual device with which I was reading it. It reminded me of the beginning of Archer a little bit. It kind of screams like Secret Agent Man theme song.
Yep.
It's done only in yellow and like light blue gray scale.
Mm-hmm.
So you're only working with two colors, and then a lot of the frames are like bordered by a maze structure.
Yes.
And the layout of the panels are turned. It, like the orientation, I think one is literally upside down and then the bottom one is sideways, and they're connected. Each panel's connected through the little like maze junctions.
Yeah, it's like you have to solve the little maze at the end of each panel to know which panel you're going to next, and it also determines the orientation of the panel.
Yeah,
and it's very hard to describe, but yeah, take a look at this if you have Marvel Unlimited. It's such a designy thing to do, and this is again like, you know, Steranko just being years ahead of anyone else with this stuff. But it struck me as being like very Will Eisner-y. He would kind of like play with panel layout and design elements inside of the page and things like that.
It was very much like this form that we've been using to tell these basic stories can be extended visually in ways that we're not getting to yet.
Yeah. Yeah, he's just like he's just going out of his way to find rules to break.
But it seems like you're saying, he is reflecting Eisner while he's, you know, reflecting what will be like Warhol or Lichtenstein. Like he's informing that level of pop art at the same time.
Yeah, he's really, really clued into things that are going on in the art world outside of comics, which is amazing. Mm-hmm. And also like the whole something I don't think we mentioned, but like this page is telling the story of Fury navigating the labyrinth of the Yellow Claw's lair. So you're actually having the experience of like going through a labyrinth as you're reading the page. It's just, it's amazing. It's like, it's such a smart, crazy, cool thing to do.
It's so hard to describe, like every bit of the motion and color, even the talk bubbles are very planned where they are and how they bleed together. It's
right. Cause they arc along with the shapes of the mazes and stuff like that.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. It's just very, very clever. It reminded me of Watchmen in certain ways. I know that's more of like the 9-panel grid structure.
Sure.
Yeah. But just like the innovation that puts you, the reader, into doing something more actively.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like just something that would be so hard to reproduce in any other medium. It's one of those things like the Watchmen.
Like there's no way to get this across in like a movie or something.
Right.
Like, yeah, you could never translate it.
That just means somebody's going to try right now. Yeah. With David Hasselhoff again. Yeah.
Yep.
Okay. Yeah. We're still doing the quick hits. Tales of Suspense number 99. Iron Man defeats Whiplash, but drains his armor's power to dangerously low levels, putting his damaged heart again at risk, etc., etc. This also features the first Silver Age artwork by EC Comics legend Johnny Craig, who inked Gene Colan's pencils. And it looks pretty good.
Yep.
Black Panther and Cap continue their fight against the resurrected Baron Zemo, who reveals that he has an orbiting death ray ready to detonate the United States nuclear bases. That's also the last issue of Tales of Suspense. At number 100, it becomes Captain America.
This also, it was the most clear I've ever understood his headpiece to be, Zemo's like purple.
Oh yeah. Yep.
Thing. Like you can see his face underneath it or through it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because it's like, sort of half glued to his face. It's like fabric glued to his face is what he's supposed
to be. Yeah, well, later on, I mean, I mostly know him from the Marvel cards in the 90s. And, like, I think at that point, it's like, skin tight a little bit.
Yeah.
Well, that's his son.
Oh, okay.
Yes. So the second Zemo Jr., he has one that's not stuck to his face.
What an aside. In Tales 2 Astonish number 101, Loki sends Hulk to Asgard, where he causes some chaos before Fandral figures out what's going on. Meanwhile, Namor has a dream of a creepy fellow wearing a strange crown while taking a nap after his fight against the Hulk last month.
This comic literally put me to sleep. I fell asleep twice. And I mean, no disrespect to the creators of this comic.
I rarely skim, but I skimmed a tiny bit on this one. I'll probably go back and read it in more detail. But I just was like, come on. It's just ripping through the pages. So he follows a mysterious urge that leads him to the Antarctic, where he finds the guy in a cavern. It turns out to be Paul Destine, a.k.a. Destiny.
And without this is whom we would not have the Atlantis Attacks? Like annual storyline from the 80s.
Wow.
Because the hat turns into the serpent crown at some point.
Yes.
Down the road. Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's all I know about Paul Destine. Sorry.
This is the last issue of Tales to Astonish. So it's renamed Incredible Hulk next month, keeping the same issue numbering. So it starts at 102. So Hulk's just, you know, that's part of the confusion of reading early Marvel comics is like Hulk. Incredible Hulk is 1 through 6, then it's canceled, then it starts again as Incredible Hulk at 102.
Yes.
And here we go.
Gosh. So Marvel numbering has been messed up from like almost literally the start.
But yeah. Fortunately, they don't do any of that nonsense anymore.
Totally straightforward.
Volume 74 of X-Men. Yeah. So the last of the quick hits is X-Men number 41. The X-Men face off against Grotesque, the subhuman, who is named that because he lives underground. But seriously, it's kind of not cool.
Don't call yourself or anyone else a subhuman. It's not great.
Yeah, not cool.
Also, Professor X is being a real jerk to everyone. But don't worry, that won't be a problem for much longer. and in the backup origins of the X-Men story, we get the next part of Cyclops' origin featuring the legendary Jack O'Diamonds, the first evil mutant that no one cared about.
Oh, yeah. Well, I wanted to zero in on a couple issues in a little bit more depth. And the first of those was Marvel Superheroes number 13. So this is the second issue of the new Captain Marvel comic. This one's called Where Stalks the Sentry. It was written by Roy Thomas with art by Gene Colan, inked by Paul Reinman. The only things I really want to mention about this, we have Marvel adjusting to life on Earth as a Kree secret agent. So Stan Lee wrote the first issue. Roy Thomas, as of issue number two, is the writer now. Stan wanted to get this off his plate as quick as he possibly could. Because if you listen to the Tom Brevoort episode, you know that this was basically just rushed into production at Martin Goodman's insistence because Fawcett had stopped publishing the Golden Age Captain Marvel. DC hadn't started publishing Captain Marvel yet. And Carl Burgos's Captain Marvel had just been sued out of existence. Martin Goodman was like, get a Captain Marvel on the books right now. We need to own that name. So they did. Stan did his duty, handed it off to Roy immediately. And what's great about this issue is that you see Roy Thomas just frantically trying to write himself out of the corners that Stan wrote himself into.
With one issue. Yeah.
With one issue. He's like, okay, well, let's see. What'll be the hero's weakness? He can't go more than an hour without wearing his helmet or he'll suffocate. Like, Stan.
But his helmet doesn't even cover his mouth. Like, it just seems, you know, it's like, it doesn't make any sense.
Maybe the Kree breathe through their ears. I don't know.
At least he doesn't fly like he's, well, he still kind of flies like he's falling. Yeah. Like he just tripped on the stairs is how he usually flies too. It's hilarious.
But Roy, in this issue, one of the first things he does is make sure he gets a massive supply of his 1 hour breathing potion so that he can. It's like, OK, this is no longer an issue. He's just going to take a swig of this every hour and we're done with this.
That's funny. I not knowing or like not having remembered all the history to it. Yeah. I was like, oh, interesting. They gave this guy a handicap. So he's not just like a Superman ripoff. And then like a moment later, they were like, oh, well, I guess they got rid of that handicap. It's like, that was weird. What just happened?
Yeah. And then like in the his first appearance, he had like a Buck Rogers like ray gun blaster. And Roy just he's like, that's not a superhero thing, Stan. And like, you know, has him like immediately converted into like wrist gauntlet blasters. So, you know, it's just great.
Was this the one with the suitcase? The luggage that everyone kept talking
about? Yeah, he's got the cylindrical suitcase. Yeah,
yeah. I was wondering if like back then there was only one suitcase
style,
you know, because Americans didn't have as many options with literally everything as they do now.
Yeah.
Yes. Like, oh, maybe there was like only one very common suitcase and like this guy doesn't have it.
He has to say like, I'm carrying a couple of telescopes or something. I don't know.
Right.
Yeah. I love that.
I'm carrying a very large map.
And all the time. Very worried about getting lost.
We still get one mention of Sentry number 459. That is, I just love how dumb it is that Sentry gets the number and that it's called out across multiple comics and then, you know, into the future. But Sentry 459 is like a keystone of the Marvel universe.
Yeah, right. Because it's the connective tissue between Fantastic Four, right? So they're tethering that.
It's one of the three or whatever pieces of Kree lore that we have at this point. It's like, well, what do we know? There's a supreme intelligence. There's Ronan the Accuser and there's Sentry 459. And so that's it. That's what we got to work with. So Sentry 459 has appeared in Fantastic Four where they encounter it on an island. Uh-huh. It's shown up in the past in an Inhuman story where it reveals that's how it lands.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And then there's, and then it shows up here. So it's like, yeah, he gets around.
Is there like an X-Men piece? It feels like he's just everywhere. Yeah, this guy just has so much charisma laying there on a slab in the story.
It is a great character design.
Yeah, he's like a cooler Sentinel is what he feels like.
Yeah, before they had to mass produce them all to be exactly the same and very like generic looking, this was like the failed prototype because it was too cool.
This was the Edsel of the Sentinels.
And this issue also it features the first appearance of a character named Carol Danvers. Miss Danvers. We are not on a first name basis with her quite yet, but there's and the first time we see her, Captain Marvel is very pointedly facing away from her and turning his back to her. So just like, hey, welcome to the Marvel Universe, Carol Danvers. The first thing we're going to do is nag you.
Yep. Calls her a girl.
We're going to give you a last name, which is something that most people don't get in their first 20 issues if they're a female character. But we're going to go ahead and give you a last name.
Yeah.
They did give her some snark right away. I think her first or second sentence was like pretty character-y.
Yeah. I was really surprised to see this character showing up so early in the run. Like, for some reason, I just always had it in my head that, you know, she was a character that was created sometime in the 70s. But, you know, obviously she doesn't get powers later, but the character has been there since 67. So,
yeah, they did some cool stuff with her. She was like writing. She was a journalist, right? She wrote Ms.
I think so.
Ms.
Yeah.
Ms. Magazine, I think.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yep. It was like, and she was connected to MJ. Spider-Man. There was a whole
Rogue
web,
and there's like a massive insanity with her. Later, it's so crazy.
Yeah, she winds up being tied into like a dozen different characters' storylines in significant ways.
Yeah, it seemed like they knew they were onto something, but didn't know exactly what to do with it for a long time.
That's what we've learned about Marvel, is they have an idea and then they just bat it around. Sometimes it takes 30, 40, 50 years. And but somehow somehow you're going to get a Guardians of the Galaxy movie out of it. You know, it's like...
Actually, thought that's the art in this. I'm not a horror expert. Mm-hmm. I'm certainly not a horror comics expert, but at a scan, this comic looks like kind of scary. Like the inking is really dark. There's a lot of shadows. There's a lot of like weird lines. The angles are kind of all over the place.
Yeah.
And I was wondering if they were, if that was intentional on any level, if they were like trying out some different approaches.
I don't know Paul Reinman as a inker. I can't remember what. Yeah, so it might be somebody who's come from like the EC stable of people too. And the
I don't know that he was an EC guy. He's been around at Marvel. He's been doing a bunch of stuff there. But it might also just be this is what their art looks like when they're working really quickly. Something out there. You know, it might just be thick, heavy ink lines because Stan is shoehorning another title into the production. So
yeah, it looks like something somewhere between EC and a Sunday comic strip, you know.
For sure. So that's what Captain Marvel's up to this month. And then the other one I wanted to take a quick look at was Daredevil number 37. The story is called Don't Look Now, But It's Doctor Doom. It's written by Stan Lee. The art is by Gene Colan, inked by John Tartaglione. If you remember the last time we saw Daredevil, he had tumbled down the stairs with Pacepot Pete, and then rolled under a train platform and blacked out because he wrenched his back. And then when he came to, he saw Dr. Doom standing there.
I love this because he almost gets beaten by the Trapster.
Yes.
Then he gets, you know, tries to save the Trapster after he does like a crazy lunge down a subway staircase. Then he wakes up at the feet of Dr. Doom and you're like, well, that's the end of Daredevil. I mean, come on, you know, Doom's just going to step on his head and that's it, you know?
Yep.
But of course, Doom's too villainous to do that straight away. Yeah.
But he does beat the hell out of him.
Yes.
Like, the first few pages of this are brutal. Like,
totally brutal.
Daredevil is so wiped out, he can't even put up a fight. And Doom is just like smashing his face into walls and things. It's just like...
And commenting, like, I don't usually, you know, get my hands dirty, but I'm going to punch the crap out of you. Yeah.
Yeah. Just got up on the wrong side of the bed. But we do get an explanation of how Doom survived the cosmic Doom storyline when he stole the Silver Surfer's power. It turns out, so if you remember at the end of that storyline, Reed Richards basically suckered Doom into trying to fly out into space, and Galactus had put the barrier in place to prevent the Silver Surfer from leaving. So it looked like Doom smashed into that like a bug onto a windshield. We didn't find out what happened to Doom, but the Surfer's board just zipped back to Doom's castle where the Silver Surfer was imprisoned. What we learn in this issue is that Doom didn't blow up when he hit the barrier. It just summoned Galactus's astral form to see what was going on. So Galactus realized that Doom was not the Surfer. So he just like kind of sent him back to Latveria.
Galactus set up like a full perimeter force field. Yes. But it was mostly like a Nest camera, like just to see if somebody rang the doorbell. And then he's like, I'll just turn on my camera and see what's up. And that's it.
Yeah. So after Doom, you know, beats the tar out of Daredevil, he brings him back to his embassy where, you know, he delivers some lines about diplomatic immunity, which is great. And then he puts him through some like legit Mysterio style head games where he's like, now you're in a room where you're very tiny. Now you're in a room where everything's on the ceiling.
Oh, is this missing?
I was taking notes on that. And I started writing before I read the page. And I was like, you know, the art on this is just, that's a mistake. Like they did a bad job. With the scale, because he looks very, very small. And then I had to delete my note.
He's like Doom's, he's like trying to psychologically break Daredevil down. It doesn't really work.
Part of it is because of Daredevil's lack of sight. Some of the things are designed to work on sighted people. So which often happens. It, you know, luckily for him, he is already blind. There's a lot of renderings of Doom that are just not that great. It's just so weird to not see Kirby drawing Doom. You can see some struggle with how to position him and how to make it not look like or make him look angrier or more menacing, but you know, it looks like his armor is just like flattened out in some cases. And it's a very weird and challenge. I mean, I know from having drawn Dr. Doom in a Kirby style, it is hard to do. His eyes can look bonkers if you move them just a tiny bit in those little windows, but they do look bonkers here. It is cool to see, you know, Galactus's astral form shooting Doom back to Earth. That's a nice splash page.
But that's the first meeting of those two guys. Doom's whole master plan here, such as it is that he is going to switch bodies with Daredevil. And this is not the first time Doom has done this, and it's not going to be the last time that Doom.
I loved when he did it to Reed.
I love that that's just like a thing that Doom does every now and then. It's like, now I'm in your body and you're in mine.
I love, again, this is the thing that Noah always talks about. This is a villain who has the technology to transplant a consciousness into a different body. He could just rule the world. He could make all the money in the whole world and run the world just by saying, I can do this. If you're going to die, let's just go ahead and move you over yonder. And, but instead he just got beat up Daredevil in a subway and is now going to put his brain in there. You know, it's going.
Yeah, I guess it's kind of like if you have a tool, you're going to like try and use it as much as possible, even in situations that don't necessarily warrant it.
You know, true. You're kinda like, I have to justify the expense.
Yeah, like the electricity bill on this thing is brutal. Like,
I love that. Yeah.
Yeah. So there we go. That our cliffhanger is that Doom is in Daredevil's body. Daredevil's in Doom's body. I think next month the story continues in the next issue of Daredevil. And then it concludes in next month's issue of Fantastic Four. So, which is kind of a cool, same month crossover type deal. They're starting to do a little bit more of that. So,
yeah, now that Stan doesn't have to write everything, he's willing to let that happen. You know,
I noticed in throughout a bunch of these, but this seems like a good enough place to talk about it. Like the notes to tell you to turn the page. And, like, I think they're so interesting. Like, why would you do that? I'm sure that, I mean, it's like funny to read in retrospect, right? Because it's like, oh, this was just a different time and things were different back then. Like, you're reading a periodical. Like, it's telling you to do something that is like entirely instinctive. Like there's no reason why you wouldn't turn a page. So like, and so I was wondering like why they do that. And then B, I was wondering how they determine when to do that.
I don't know if they have like, it's like Stan's natural, unnecessary hype level, which yeah. I mean, maybe isn't unnecessary after I'm starting to get like Stockholm syndrome, just from Stan's, sort of like hyperbole. I feel like, you know, we need to talk about this podcast like it's the greatest thing. And if you don't miss the next one, you're going to regret the entire rest of your life. And, you know, that's what I feel like when I hear Stan's hype. Like, it's
I totally get that on the first page and on the last page, right? Like,
right.
You have to check. If you're at a stand right now, you need to take this comic home because it's going to blow your mind. I totally get that. And then one at the end to be like, definitely get the next one too. Like,
yeah.
That but like middle of the issue, it just seems
which reminds me
now.
like, well, I wasn't going to until you interrupted me.
Now that you've listened this far in the podcast, we should take a break, but when we come back, you're going to want to hear what happens, so wait for another 10 seconds. Welcome back to the amazing thing I was telling you about, The Amazing Spider-Man, here on Marvel by the Month. This is Amazing Spider-Man number 58, called To Kill a Spider. It's written by Stan Lee, art by Don Heck.
To Kill a Spider-Man.
Sorry, To Kill a Spider-Man. That's not a comma. To Kill a Spider-Man. Written by Stan Lee, art by Don Heck, with Mickey DeMeo, who is Mike Esposito. Here's the quick summary. The issue begins with Kazar fishing the amnesiac Spider-Man out of the lake that he nearly drowned in last issue. When Spidey comes to, he realizes he's recovered his memory. Yeah.
If you can't hit someone who's lost their memory on the head really hard to get their memory back, you can also nearly drown them.
Yeah. There's a lot of ways to fix hiccups.
Medically approved method for restoring someone's memory.
Yeah. The amnesiac ward in hospitals is just
a big mallet,
hammers and tiny pools.
It's just an aquarium, basically.
So Spidey's got his memory back. Meanwhile, Professor Smythe, who built J. Jonah Jameson, a Spidey hunting robot in Amazing Spider-Man number 25, is back with a new trick. Actually, it's the same exact trick. He's calling this one a Spider Slayer. This one is larger, more powerful than the previous one, but it still displays the operator's face on a screen in its head. It does look like a more actually mobile robot.
And it's great that it has the screen, because this means that Jonah can control it. And once again, we can have killer robot with Jonah's face chasing after Spider-Man. And I also think it's funny, like Smythe says, I call it the Spider Slayer. And Jonah's like, geez, I mean, do we have to kill the guy? He's like, oh, no, it's just hype. It's just hype. But I mean, no, this thing is absolutely designed to just murder Spider-Man.
Yeah. And it's interesting to see that Jameson's like, I just want to, like, you know, take his mask off and make him feel bad and humiliated. That's all I want. I don't want
his
to kill the guy.
So
yeah.
Small.
He's such a petty guy.
Yeah. I just want to ruin his life. I don't want to kill him. So, the spider
be crazy about this.
Yeah.
You don't want to use your giant robot suit for murder.
So it starts this, you know, Jonah faced robots, starts to stalk Spidey through the city. Spidey is exhausted and out of web fluid and trying to figure out where Aunt May is. And suddenly he's attacked in his own apartment. Because this, like the previous Spider Slayer robot, it can sense spiders. So it goes after the most spider it can sense.
And there's only one spider in Manhattan. So it's really easy to track down.
Right. Yeah. It's either going to go to somebody's basement or it's going to find Spider-Man, you know, one of the two.
And fortunately, Jonah, when the Spider Slayer locks onto Spider-Man and sees him like sticking his head out of Peter Parker's apartment window, he doesn't assume this is where Spider-Man lives. He's like, he must be trying to break into someone's apartment. So secret identity, totally saved.
Because Jonah believes Spider-Man just lives nonstop, just prowling around, has no life other than to be a villain.
Or a menace.
A menace. Sorry.
Or a threat.
So Spidey is completely outmatched. When Smythe takes over the controls from Jonah, Spidey hatches a plan to find Smythe in his lab. So Smythe's face appears on the robot when he takes over the controls, and that's how he knows that.
Yeah. And of course, he does what we have seen before. When a Marvel character needs to do some research on where someone lives, they go and grab a phone book from a payphone.
Yep. And he gets to the phone book in time to find Smythe's lab.
Do you remember how he's able to figure out which Smythe is the one he's looking for?
Is it the one that has doctor, or is it the one?
Scientist.
Scientist. Right. Oh, okay. I remembered it was something improbable, but I guess if I was in a normal phone book now, I would try to get the title Science Lord put up there, even though I really am not qualified for that.
Yeah. I would absolutely put podcaster because there's only 300,000 or 400,000 of those out there.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
So now he's Smythe laughs at Spidey because he and Jonah are actually at the Daily Bugle offices. They had gone back there. So they're just holed up in Jonah's office, you know, trying to kill Spider-Man. But Spidey lures the Spider Slayer into a lab, into Smythe's lab, which is full of spiders, which confuses and overloads the Spider Slayer. So his, his understanding of how the Spider Slayer might be trying to track him makes him come up, hatch this plan to, quickly.
Well, I think he knew from the previous Spider Slayer, because wasn't it something like,
it was demonstrated.
They were demonstrating. Reacted. It's like, here, Peter, hold this spider. And then the robot attacked him. And yeah. But also, like, I mean, if he built this thing, at some point it had to be in his lab, right? And it didn't overload with all the spiders then.
Maybe true, the but it didn't have Spider-Man and a bunch of spiders. Oh, like that's the Spider-Man is like basically a man made of spiders, as everyone knows.
that's the creepiest Halloween costume
ever. He's Mr. Oogie Boogie Man, but with the Spider-Man costume.
Spidey gets out of this one. Spider Slayer number 2 bites the dust. There are so many Spider Slayers. This is going to be a thing for the next 5 years of this podcast. It's going to be great.
Yeah, it's like there are possibly more Spider Slayers than Iron Man suits or Sentinels. It's the same kind of level of, you know, of constant iteration and evolution to create the perfect Spider Slayer.
And then the other thing to mention about this issue is that we've had an art change on Amazing Spidey. So Don Heck is now your regular Spider-Man artist with this issue. Something that they don't explicitly credit, though, is that Romita is still doing layouts and touch-ups for the book. So, I was pleasantly surprised with how good the art looked. And then I did a little bit more digging. It's like, oh, Romita is still laying out the pages for him. It was just Romita at the time could not keep up with the production demands. And he was also being pulled in a lot of different directions. He eventually winds up becoming, I think, Marvel's art director or production director or something like that. And he kind of winds up overseeing all the art for the company. And if anything needs fixing, he winds up fixing it. So Don Heck is your new Spider-Man artist, but it's a pretty solid issue.
At least this going over, you know, I have a feeling that some of the art in here is straight up Romita, and then it, you know, he just blocks out a few things as it gets towards the end, because this is like the best art I've seen from Don Heck.
I think definitely the Spider-Man figures are very Romita. I think he's really making sure those are tightened up.
Even the panel,
there's a couple of pages where that they're like walking on the sides of buildings or on the tops of buildings, the perspective is really interesting, and it looks very, it reminded me of Inception when they're fighting in the rotating building. It's like two or three pages worth of you're just not exactly sure which way is up. Pretty cool.
Yep.
This also had my as a kid, I was always concerned about him running out of web fluid. Mm-hmm. And it actually happened in this one, and it was fine. You know, like, he wasn't mid-swing. He was like, oh, I just have to go get more of that.
Yep.
You know, and I have plenty, so it's not a problem.
Yeah. Yep. Yep. In the meantime, I'll just run along these rooftops.
It's not like Iron Man with his, you know, energy, right. His battery running out all the time, or early Johnny Storm, man, who did not have any way to gauge when he was going to run out of firepower and fall out of the sky. That was just his jam. Yeah.
I'm going to fly 500 feet in the air because my power could cut out at any moment. So there you go. There's your Spider-Man for the month. We'll take one final break. And then when we come back, we will talk about what Thor is up to this month here on Marvel by the Month. Welcome back to Marvel by the Month. We are going to talk about Thor number 149. The story is called When Falls a Hero. It's written by Stan Lee. The art is by Jack Kirby, inked by Vince Coletta. So last issue, we met the third Wrecker of the Marvel Age of Comics, third character to have the code name. He's the one who's going to be sticking around for a while. The other two didn't really stick, but this is the Wrecker you know and loathe. He's basically just a thug with a crowbar who accidentally gained the powers of a god when the Norn Queen charged him up accidentally, thinking he was Loki because he was wearing Loki's hat at the time. So it's an easy mistake.
Norn Queen's not too into details, just like,
there's a lot of mystical vapor, you know.
Yeah.
But Thor, on the other hand, does not have his godly powers. He just has his innate Asgardian super strength because he didn't do exactly what Odin wanted when Odin wanted him to do it. So, you know, there you go. So you got the Wrecker. He's just rampaging through New York. He's totally living up to his name, just trashing Thor, any buildings that happen to be near Thor at the time. There's some amazing scenes of destruction in this issue. There's several scenes where Wrecker is just like running a crowbar through a wall of bricks. And it's really nice.
He smashes a truck in half with the crowbar. Yeah.
Yep.
They have a fight. They have a fight in a junkyard, right? Mm-hmm. And Thor is depowered. And it reminded me of, is it Superman 3?
Yes.
Where he doesn't have the powers and he fights the other him in the junkyard.
Yep. He gets put in the compactor.
Yeah. It was like some Richard Donner-esque character in the movie biz probably read this.
And everything about it, I mean, in having grown up around the towing and junkyard businesses, you call a tow truck a wrecker, so every time I see the word wrecker, I think of like my family and my dad's tow truck or whatever. It's just like, I've always had a special affinity for the Wrecker because he's so blue collar and he's such a normal guy who has way too much power and isn't super smart, but he knows how to bash.
Yeah. I was wondering if there was some kind of like, I'm not smart enough to figure stuff like this out, but I was wondering if there was some kind of metaphor there where you've got like a working class guy fighting a literal golden god.
I think so. Yeah.
But like the working class guy is bad, which doesn't seem Marvel-y. Like,
well, that's true. Yeah.
I think this is kind of Kirby's upbringing coming in where it's like, I'm sure he knew a guy like this, you know, from his childhood when he was running with street gangs, you know, just some real meathead thug, you know, who like smacked people around. The Wrecker's face is so wide. It's just like, it's like as wide as his body almost. His mouth is just this slit that goes all the way across his face. He has
giant teeth.
Yeah. So many square, uneven teeth. Like, yeah. He must have like 150 teeth in his mouth.
Also, as we said last, I think it was the last time, Wrecker is dressed as a default henchman for any other supervillain ever.
Yes.
Like, outfit is basically just, there should be eight of him and they should be doing the work of somebody much more powerful or interesting.
Yeah. Wow.
He looks like he's like dressed to do an oil change, but then he threw on a purple ski mask to go around the bank like on his lunch break.
Yep. Yeah. It's a little like Days of Future Past, those green jumpsuits with the M on them. Yep. It looks a lot like that, but with like a purple sash.
Yeah. So let's see, the Wrecker makes pretty short work of Thor, leaves him in a heap, heads out to do some crimes. Thor rallies because he's a hero. He goes after the Wrecker again as the Wrecker's leaving a bank that he just robbed. But once again, the Wrecker is just too much for Thor. Even after Thor goes through all the trouble of stealing the Wrecker's crowbar with his feet, in a very weird athletic move, he's like climbing up some scaffolding and like, just like yoinks the crowbar away with his feet. Then we cut back to Asgard. Balder and Sif are appealing to Odin to save Thor before the Wrecker just flat out murders him. But they're having trouble because, first of all, Odin's a stubborn guy. And second of all, he just doesn't believe that anyone in Midgard could really present a serious threat to Thor, even without his godly powers. He's like, no, he's still Asgardian. He's going to be fine. Like, he's going to learn his lesson, tough love, et cetera, et cetera.
It's like almost misguided parent sweet a little bit.
Yeah.
He's like, oh, my kid, he'll be fine. Like, he'll figure it out.
But at the same time, we have Odin behaving like this is the second time, I think, in this run where Odin suddenly, it's sort of like Professor X, like for no reason. Like I think there's going to be like, oh, Odin has some eternal space bug that went in his mind and made him suddenly angry. It's nothing. It's just Odin, you know, got a hangnail and was decided he was going to depower Thor for not doing exactly what he said. You know, it's, he just gets so out of his character. I mean, his character, then it just becomes more of this mercurial personality where it doesn't seem like the all wise, all knowing, all father. It just seems like, I mean, he seems like a dad, like a bad dad, like just a jerk.
Yeah.
He seems really Zeus-like. I feel like this is like much more of a character trait that we see when Zeus is introduced later. But and also just
Zeus mythology. Already did this too. Zeus kicked Hercules out of Olympus, and that's why he's living on a couch at Avengers Mansion. You know,
This Marvel Comics is all about the generational struggle, man.
Wrecker calls Thor long hair. Like,
yes,
yeah, that happens quite a lot in these.
Yeah. Oh man. So yeah. So they're anyway. So Balder and Sif, they're working on Odin. He's not buying it. So they're like, well, just go take a look. So they go to Odin's Chamber of Visions where he can look down at Midgard. But Loki has sabotaged it. He stole an enchanted crystal that powers it. So he can't see how desperate Thor's situation has become. So he's still not convinced. So Sif and Balder get Odin's permission to head to the Norn Forest because Balder has a pretty good idea who took the crystal and he has a pretty good idea of where he went. So they ride out to the Norn Forest to try to find Loki and get the crystal back. And then meanwhile, back on Midgard, the Wrecker hops in an Earth Mover and pins Thor up against a wall just for funsies, just having a really great time. And then Thor is like, he's trying to climb up a tenement. They don't really explain why, whether he's trying to escape or maybe he's trying to steal the crowbar with his feet again. I don't know. And the Wrecker just brings it crashing down around him.
He just pries the whole thing over with the crowbar. Yeah. I mean,
just tips. Yeah. Yep. And then the last panel we see is a lifeless Thor with the Wrecker saying he won't ever fight the Wrecker or anyone else anymore. And so the Wrecker just basically murdered Thor. Thor is dead. Like when we start the next issue, like, yeah, you will see like he's dead. So I don't know where we go from here, but
guess there that's the last we'll ever see a Thor.
That's the last we'll ever see a Thor. Pretty good debut for the Wrecker. pretty good putting him over. I mean, the Absorbing Man gave Thor a really hard time, but Wrecker flat out killed him.
So. Yeah. I like it later when they're on a team. Like, that's even better. Like, if you think about them now, how much they've been put over. Like, yeah. You combine those two and you've got like a tag team match that you can't handle. yeah, I do like in the one thing I like about these specific issues is Sif continues to be like one of the strongest female characters in Marvel. Yeah. Everyone's like, turn back. No lady should go here. And she's like, shut up. I'm coming. I'm like the best sword you've got, you know? Yeah. So there is just a little bit of that first hint of, I mean, granted she's a god, but, you know, this first hint of a very real strong female character.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's definitely progress from where like Sue Storm was.
Yeah. Or even now she's just like the baby holder that needs to be protected and not.
Oh yeah. Right. He's just like escorting her on the train and stuff. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was rough. That was a rough issue.
Man, anything else we want to say about this issue? The only thing I wanted to mention about the issue is one more time, just to talk about how much I love like the scenes of destruction in this, like just the smashing of buildings. It's another one of those issues where Kirby is just being turned loose to do a whole bunch of property destruction. And I even have to give Vince Coletta a lot of credit on the inking with this. Like a lot of times, you know, the knock on Coletta is that he simplified things. He even like didn't draw the backgrounds or, you know, didn't ink the backgrounds or even just like remove characters from the background so he wouldn't have to ink them.
Yeah.
I feel like this one, he actually, you know, there's a lot of, you know, pretty strong rendering in this. So,
yeah, some of the, I mean, even like the building crashing on Thor, his Coletta's inking style, which is like really varied in line width and things like that, it works well for a building that's falling on someone.
Yeah.
Like Sinnott's like really clean lines would be, which we've seen, it's great, but it just doesn't have quite that destructive feel to it.
Yeah.
So there is, I mean, I did complain to you. I know we were texting as we do about the issues as we're reading them. And I'm like, Coletta, man, what if Sinnott was doing this, it would be so good. But
yeah,
when you say that, I can see some pluses.
Yeah. But this one plays to his strengths a little bit. Maybe he had an extra 30 minutes to ink this issue.
Yeah. Being the man who could hit all deadlines at whatever cost to the art. Yeah.
And, yeah. It's literally his one skill. It's like he can hit any deadline.
I thought it's something I never really noticed much, is that sometimes the backgrounds are very detailed and sometimes they are one flat color.
Yep.
And I suspect that that sort of accented a little bit more looking at these comics remastered in a digital format.
I think you're right. Yeah.
It really pops. And like sometimes it comes off as cheap and like that they weren't trying hard enough, but sometimes it accentuates the action in a very satisfying, like well-focused way. Mm-hmm. So I think that like a case can be made that there's times when you absolutely can and maybe should do that.
Yeah. And I think Kirby even draws it that way sometimes. It just depends. But if there's a scene with like when Wrecker's running his crowbar through a wall with a bunch of cops on the other side, there's, you know, like four cops that you see in that scene, and this is on page 7, but it's, you can almost guarantee that there were 8 cops drawn by Jack Kirby.
right.
So he just,
Vince gave 4 of them the day off.
Yeah, crowd scenes like that, he will just pare them down because he's like, I'm not gonna draw another face in here, there's already 4, come on.
Right.
Yeah,
there is a backup story with Black Bolt in that.
Yeah,
I thought that was actually a pretty cool story.
Yeah, Black Bolt's adolescence.
Yeah, I mean, you know, to have a white man who cannot speak or be heard. What a fantastic tale.
Fortunately, every other white man in the story more than makes up for that.
Yeah, they certainly
Stan's
do.
Writing it. But no, yeah, it's the story of with Black Bolt's, was it 19th birthday, where he's finally trusted to not talk.
To leave his silence chamber.
And so it's like, because when he was a baby, he cried and almost destroyed the city. And so they've had him, you know, under sonic lockdown since then. And then this is where he gets to meet. So his cousin is Medusa.
Yeah.
Do I have
the, Karnak? It says that Karnak, Gorgon, and Medusa are his cousins.
And Crystal is as well. And she's Medusa's sister. Yeah. But yeah, everyone's a little bit younger.
Crystal's a kid. Younger. Yeah, she's like a child. Old.
Yeah. We also see Maximus, Black Bolt's brother. He gets in and, you know, immediately causes some chaos.
Tries to shoot Black Bolt so that he cries out in pain.
Yeah. Yes.
Right away. And
because he doesn't want him to be able to go out and live a life, because if he can't leave his isolation, then he can't be the king of the Inhumans, which means that Maximus would wind up getting the crown.
So yeah,
right. You can see, like, right from the early days, you know, that was Maximus's whole move. So
yeah. It's how come, maybe my Inhumans knowledge is not good, how come he had powers at birth? Do like the core Inhumans have them at birth, or is it not, they don't need the Terrigenesis or any of that stuff?
Some of these early Inhumans are just born powered.
Okay.
Or at least they are at this phase. They might be retconned to go through Terrigenesis. So, like, I'm guessing Triton just came out as a fish man, and they're like, "Oh well, what are we gonna do with this?"
Stick him in the aquarium wing on the amnesia.
Yeah,
yeah. I'm not sure they have the rules down for it yet, because they like an ancient king of the Inhumans did go into the mists, into the Terrigen mists, and got the powers from there. But I think that's the only person we've actually seen exposed to it. I think they just said, it's like, this is where the Inhumans got their powers from. But I don't know that at this point it's been stipulated that everyone has to be exposed to the mists.
Or we can, you know, ask people to write in and tell us what we got wrong, which is
tell us what wondrous. We should have remembered from what we already read.
What we already told you.
I don't know if you can count on the internet to tell you when you're wrong.
Well, I feel like Stan Lee did that every time there's a letters page. Is like somebody writes in why something didn't happen, and that's an excuse for a no prize to be triggered. And or they write in the, you know, the solution as they point out what they did wrong. So, you know, I feel like there's precedence.
Yeah. Crowdsourcing your continuity, man. It's a good gimmick. Stanley's a genius.
Genius.
That's our comics for the month, gentlemen. So now the only thing that remains is for us to recommend some other comics to read that were not these comics. I will kick off the recommendations. I've been going back through all of the flavors of the Brian Michael Bendis era of Avengers. So that would be new, Dark, Mighty, and The. I don't think I've read them since they were originally released. And I'm not sure. I don't think I read all of them. I think I stopped reading somewhere around Secret Invasion for reasons I don't recall. But like going back through them now and reading it all collectively, it is such a long string of excellence for a flagship title. Mm-hmm. And like, more importantly, did exactly what a flagship title needs to do, which is like, it's putting stories out there that have so many hooks for other titles to latch onto and to tell great stories around. I get really exhausted really quickly with like the big event storylines. You know, they're time consuming, they are wallet draining. But during this era, like, I think Bendis did them about as well as they've ever been done. If you have not gone back and looked at those in a while, I highly recommend it. I think all of the stuff is on Marvel Unlimited. So just like block out a few evenings in a week and just dig in. You'll treat yourself.
Those busted open my Marvel interest to an amazing degree. I was very myopically X-Men focused for 15, 20 years, I don't know, forever. Mm-hmm. And then I don't even know how or why I picked up one of those first new Avengers books. I think it was just like a random fluke. And I was immediately hooked and worked forward and worked backwards. They were game changing for me.
Yeah.
Me real, too. Real good. When I stopped reading superhero comics, it was mainly because I felt like characters weren't being developed really anymore. They weren't like post Claremont, you know, it sort of closed back in a little bit where there were, you know, a lot of episodes that are bottle issues, and then there were a lot of crossovers. So it was just like a character trying to become something between crossovers, you know?
Yeah, it's like a plant trying to grow on a path where people are walking. It just right. keeps...
Yeah, yeah.
Which I'm sure is the frustration of every major comics writer ever who isn't in charge of plotting the crossover. But I felt like this worked, and this, you know, Bendis touched like a lot of the ancillary issues too, the, you know, pieces mm-hmm. that the spinoffs and the other chunks. And it was just, I read it. And I read this while we were doing the podcast, but I read probably 100 extra issues of just this stuff. And that happens regularly with Marvel Unlimited, which justifies my expense, much like mm-hmm. Dr. Doom transferring his mind into someone else.
Yes. Also, shout out to our good friend Tom Brevoort, who edited all of that stuff. Like, that's also like a thankless editorial job, is like keeping everything pointed in the same direction and making sure that everything is consistent, and you are, you know, figuring out, it's like, okay, so all this stuff is happening here. What does this mean for the Young Avengers? What does this mean for Thor? What does this mean for Captain America? And like, you know, making sure everyone's pulling in the same direction.
So, okay, that I totally obviously agree. I went totally in a very different direction this month this week for my recommendation. Since we were a bit ahead on recording on the holidays, I finally had time to get into one of my several foot stacks of graphic novels that I've been purchasing but not reading. And I have a few recommendations, but I'll give them out one episode at a time. So ooh. what a cliffhanger.
the title Stanley.
Yeah, I'm really pouring in the stand tonight. The title that has stuck with me the most from reading a lot of fantastic comics was Pretty Deadly by Kelly Sue DeConnick and Emma Rios. It's beautiful. It's the publishing started in 2013. It's still running, thank goodness. It's a story as grand in scope and in a creation of its own mythology as Neil Gaiman's Sandman, with the first arc with some brutal Western touches like Enis's Saint of Killers and The Preacher. It's like, it just reminded me of all these things at once. It combines both weird period pieces, non-linear storytelling, and ambitious world building. And tells the tale of Death's Daughters and the Reapers, which are these godlike beings. It's all narrated by a skeleton bunny talking to a butterfly. It's so good. So, it's really good. Yeah, I've read three volumes now of the graphic novels, and I'm in love. Yeah.
Yeah. They're beautiful. They're beautiful and just so cool. Just
yes.
Yeah. Lovingly crafted.
Yeah. It's what one of those things that this is what comics are for. Like they're built for this kind of storytelling.
Yeah. Yeah. Jamie, what do you got for recommendation for this month?
Yeah. So the holidays just ended. And I every year take that as an opportunity to buy people who wouldn't normally read comics. So many comics. I'll do this quickly. Dan Slott's Silver Surfer run, start to finish, there it's like the numbers reset halfway through because
of course
Marvel. Yeah. But what a beautiful, stunning story that left me crying to the point of a headache at the end.
Wow.
It is just so amazingly well done. And it starts off so goofy and silly and not taking itself too seriously. Like, I'm not a Silver Surfer guy by nature. It's just a little too cosmic, and it humanized that whole the whole zone was just really well done. I can't speak highly enough of it. So I bought that one for my mom. Nice. So she's working her way through that. Chelsea Kane wrote a book called Man Eaters. I think it's plural.
Yes.
Correct me if I'm wrong. Katie at the comic shop is the only one I've like seen talking about this book, but it blew me away. It is so sweet and cute and smart and funny and just insightful. It feels like the other half of Bitch Planet, kind of. Mm-hmm. Like the two to me feel like they fit together in an interesting way. Like they're doing maybe not similar things, but it just one is like the hard edge and one is the soft edge.
Yeah. And I think they're both categorized as sort of feminist literature at this point. And I know Chelsea Kane is, you know, I have her whole Mockingbird run too.
Yeah. Oh my God. I bought, that's another thing I bought for three coworkers. I bought volumes of, of Mockingbird. It's just, it's so accessible and funny and smart.
Yeah.
And then one more, sorry. Brian was just going on about how good Jimmy Olsen was, and I didn't want to believe him. It's like a DC thing, and that's really emotionally difficult for me. I just, but I cracked, and I thought that it was goofy and irreverent and silly, and then over time it gels into like a very cohesive and like maybe brilliant thing.
Oh yeah,
I mean it. Like the convoluted knots that then write themselves at the end. It's like watching a, what do you call it? Like an Olympic person who runs and jumps on the thing and does 20 backflips and then like nails the landing.
Yes.
It was like, I didn't even see it coming. I mean, it was just so amazing. That's another one I now have to buy for like four or five people.
Yeah. I was blown away. I'm a huge Matt Fraction fan to begin with, but, yeah, it just, I think that was just, it was the kind of thing I have not seen him do before. And not just that it was a DC book, but.
Well, it's like he does funny really well, right? Like, and he distills things down really well. Like that, the Hawkeye run is like a perfect example. He just took something big and made it bite-size and personal.
Uh-huh.
And that felt really impressive. And then like Sex Criminals is like super funny, super like, juvenile but also beautiful and loving and wonderful. And this is, so you think you know him as a creator, and then he did that
and he does this. Well, Jamie, thank you so much for joining us again, and especially on such a weird funny day to be recording a podcast. But no, it's always a pleasure to have you here. We're already looking forward to your fifth appearance.
Thank you, sorry I talk so much. I didn't say iconic once this time.
That's nice. But also, right, that's what we do here is we talk and then we record it. And so the more you talk, the more we don't talk. And it's perfect.
You're welcome.
Here's our outro housekeeping. Apple Podcast reviews, or any podcast service that allows you to review a podcast. We sure would love your 5-star ratings and reviews. If you'd like to get some free stuff in the mail, send us a screenshot of your 5-star review to marvelbythemonth@gmail.com. That is what our listener Dan did when he wrote, "I wish I had known about this podcast at the start of this horrible year. Prior to 2020, I got my Marvel conversation fix from my coworkers, but after we all got fired during the shutdown, we lost touch. While I still miss my old friends, this show has re-sparked my love of silly comic book nonsense and reminded me of all the fun I had back then."
Thanks, Dan.
That was very, very touching to read. And I think that is absolutely what the show does for us too.
That's why we do this. This is our version of Clerks. Yeah.
Yeah, it kind of is. Yeah. I mean, this, like, Zoom calls are how we have to socialize now. So might as well record them and share them with people on the internet.
Yeah. So. Oh, I wanted to jump in and thank all of our listeners from the old US of A and the growing numbers from other more stable places like Canada, the EU, Australia, New Zealand, and in the UK, if we count it out of the EU.
I think we have to now.
I really appreciate the expanding listenership, and I'm just amazed. I mean, and granted, many of these are English speaking countries, but there's a lot of people in Germany and Norway, and it's I'm starting to go like, we're gonna get to do a world tour someday. Just keep listening, and that'll give us an excuse to go spend even more money. Thank you.
I can't wait to do a Canadian show so that we can wear our matching Alpha Flight t-shirts.
That's true. I do. Any excuse to wear an Alpha Flight t-shirt and like a Rush bandana. I'm down. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh man. Well, I believe in all of those wonderful places that you just mentioned. You can follow us on Instagram at Marvel by the Month. Our website is available also to the entire world. MarvelByTheMonth.com has links to our other social channels, as well as our online shop. So that's it for this week. We'll be back next week because that's what we do. Until then, my name is Brian Stratton.
And mine is Rob Milne.
And please stay safe, stay healthy, and stay inside and read comics.
Welcome back to Marvel by the Men. Mint? Menthol? Menthol? welcome back. 1 second.